Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Representing for a second time,
Whip Snakes Lacrosse Club!
Oh! Chase, was that you?
Oh, no.
Uh-oh.
Did you break the trophy?
No.
Yeah, it was, that was pretty crazy.
Oh! What? What?
You gotta get the ball to 42.
Run Lacrosse!
Hello and welcome back to the PLL Happy Hour podcast alongside Chris Rosenthal. I'm Kevin Brown. Rosie, coming off a fun Denver weekend. How we doing? How we feeling? What's going on in your mind right now?
I'm doing great, feeling great. Denver had high expectations. We'd kind of been talking about them all season, and it sounds like they delivered in all categories they possibly could have.
All categories except the clean sweep. Denver Outlaws get the doubleheader split. They lost the opener to the Maryland Whipsnakes and then avenged that game with quite the defensive showdown with the Carolina Chaos. The best defense in the league, and then they just were like, hey, our defense is going to do even better than what your defense is going to do. The Outlaw fans looked awesome. Just in giddy up cowboy gear, and the cowbells were ringing. Chris, just it hit the nail on the head there. Just this crowd was bumping, and at Peter Barton Stadium, it is easy to feel the intimate setting with the mountain drawings on the turf is drawn a lot of criticism, but it was fun to see for all fans, but especially the fans near and dear to Denver. The Eric Law experience, the Westberg game winner in overtime, then Friday night's action, and then to start Saturday with a clash between, in my opinion, what should be classified as the two best teams in the league. The two teams, I think, that are the class of the PLL. Not so fast for the defending champs. And then we end out with that game, as I mentioned, the Outlaws closing it out, becoming the first to clinch their spot in the West for a postseason berth. Now, here's the playoff picture so far. The New York Outlaws have all but clinched the Eastern Conference bye week with a 7-2 record and a score differential that seems to be not catchable at this stage with one game remaining. The Boston Cannons are 6-2, but they play the Carolina Chaos, and as I said before, that's a stingy defense, so gonna have a tough task to overcome that score differential in the final week. And they've had their playoff spot clinched as well. They had their own bye week this week during the week 10 action. And the Maryland Whipsnakes end the season on a four-game win streak. They've been clinched since their homecoming at Homewood, and continued that momentum through their regular season finale with now their bye week going into Utah action. And finally, the Outlaws become the fourth team, the first in the West to clinch. Rosie, what a playoff picture we have. It's kind of haphazard here with all the different realignments of where different teams are at this stage of the season. But as we reach the final week of the PLL season, really, it's just the best of the West to be decided, as well as who is going to sneak into that last playoff spot, because it's looking quite unlikely for the California Redwoods with that score differential. But they did themselves some favors to give themselves a chance at 3-6 now with the overtime win against the Water Dogs. Rosie, what do you make of the playoff picture heading into the final week?
Yeah, like you mentioned with the Redwoods, they are a minus 31 right now, which is far from ideal. You know, it wouldn't, I mean, they still would have been in a pretty unfortunate spot, but that Homewood game against the Outlaws really is a big swing for those guys. You know, the Outlaws being atop the West right now certainly helps them out. They've got a score differential at zero. And they're already set to, you know, having clinched this past weekend. The Redwoods probably going to take a little bit of suspense out of that attribute. And like we said, Water Dogs are already gone as well. And then once you get in, I think as Carolina has shown us in past years, it's really all about just the getting in. And then it's just going to come down to who can deliver at the right times. You know, the thing we've heard, Andy Towers say it, and, you know, we've heard several, just fans and observers saying it, you know, oh, you don't want to catch this team at the right time, you know, feel bad for anybody who's going to go against us. And these guys all kind of actually do have a good claim to stake when they say that. You know, if your record is atrocious, then I'm inclined to not be that scared of you. But all these guys are pretty much in a similar neighborhood record-wise. You know, Carolina and Utah, you know, we're looking at a half-game difference there, right? So it's not so much that anybody is really just barely sneaking in or something like that. That's kind of the benefit, if you will, of a team like Philadelphia losing almost all of their games. You don't have too many teams with also terrible records and somebody kind of just eking their way in. All of these guys are pretty close, and it's going to make things very interesting moving forward.
And one team who definitely did not sneak their way into the playoffs, riding high off a four-game win streak here, the Maryland Whipsnakes. My, oh my, the class of the league, as the champions of the first two seasons of the PLL, have reemerged with a different cast on offense, their marquee rookie on defense, the third overall pick, Ajax Apatello, sliding in quite nicely with Tim Muller and the effervescent Matt Dunn. And Brennan Krebs has taken that starting goalie position just completely under wraps. Joe Nardella, his comeback story continues to amaze, and we're due for kind of a good feature story on him in the coming weeks. Rosie, this one surprised me. I forget where you were on the staff picks graphic. But I had the Outlaw. The problem I have with picking for the homecoming teams is that if you get the first one wrong, then you're like, I definitely think they're going to split. So they're going to get the second one. So you're going to get both wrong if you get the first one wrong. I thought the Outlaws would continue this momentum from their Baltimore win. But no, it was the Whipsnakes that continued their momentum from a terrific homecoming weekend. Rosie, just did you see this playing out like this? Kind of a cruising to victory win for the Whips?
Well, I will be happy to tell you what I predicted for this one. I got this right. I knew it all along. I went 4-0 this week. I will be happy to tell you that, and it will probably never happen again. Let's go. But since you asked, I will bring it up because you asked.
Of course.
So I did not anticipate, you know, Maryland winning by a touchdown, but I kind of thought it would probably be more like a 15-13 kind of game, you know, big track meets, just kind of throwing punches. And then I thought Maryland would end up victorious just because of what I saw from them out at Homewood. The team is just really, really scary. And you know, for good reason. There are teams above them, right? You know, you got Atlas, and, you know, you have teams that have established their places, and for very good reason. But when you look at or you talk about these Whipsnakes, what I found stuck out is you're kind of constantly reminded what kind of credentials these guys bring to their resumes. Like I asked Jim Stagnita about Matt Dunn's progression this week, just because I was curious, like, you know, he's had this role as kind of, you know, their top defenseman for years and years, But it's different now, right? You know, you don't have Michael Earhart. You didn't have Kyle Burnmore because they moved on from him. So I just imagined he had a different sort of role as far as leadership was concerned. And, you know, Jim Stagnita, like the first thing he said was just kind of reminding me, like, you know, well, he was Defensive Player of the Year, you know, in 2020. And I mean, I knew that, but, you know, he's just saying like, hey, you know, he's been good. You know, he was a little hurt last year and coming off of the World Games, had some injuries to deal with and that. So, you know, I guess Stagnita felt he wasn't at his best. And I think Dunn would agree with that. But, you know, you think about somebody like him. Oh, yeah. Okay. Defense Player of the Year. Nardella, he mentioned, yeah, he was Faceoff Man of the Year. You know, two of their three attackmen are Attackmen of the Year and MVPs. Right. And it was a little while ago, a few years, but not so many years ago. It wasn't like, you know, 10 or 15 or something like that. And we've seen what like Zed Williams is doing this year. And then you add the new parts like you discussed as well, like your TJ Malone's into the mix. And it's just kind of a top to bottom scary team. And so I just imagined after, you know, they put together the wins in Maryland, I thought maybe they can just keep this going. And I see nothing stopping them from kind of continuing their climb. They're continuing to peak, I think.
They did not look this scary at 2-4. Here they are finishing their regular season at 6-4. And you talk about the newcomers. No newer comer to this Whipsnakes offense than the trade acquisition in the middle or a couple days after they beat this very team, the Water Dogs. They trade a second round pick in the 2025 draft. Not a draft that's sized up to be all that great in certain positions, certainly offensively, for the Water Dogs midfielder Ryan Conrad coming out of Virginia. So he joins the Whips, and what an impact he has.
Yeah, just right away. I think the question coming in, nobody was ever questioning Ryan Conrad's athletic ability or, you know, his if he still has it, you know, because he's still relatively young. You know, it's not a matter of, oh, is he washed up or anything like that. But I think the question would be how he's going to fit in with the team and what his role is going to be as someone who is kind of a tweener. You know, he'll do this, he'll do that. He's got all sorts of skills. So, you know, oh, maybe they run him out and have him play defensive midfield more to kind of fortify that side or whatever. So, you know, there's a mystery as to how they were going to play him. And effectively what they did were they were like, hey, you can do everything, go do everything, right? And now they're like, they're running inverts now. And I mean, what? How? They're still adding dimensions to this offense. It's so scary to think, oh, okay, so if you put a short stick defensive midfielder on Ryan Conrad, you know, even though he just grabbed the ball off the wing, he's going to go, you know, run an invert against you. And then you have to worry about sliding to him and having him dish to somebody like Zed Williams, who's just going to be wide open up top, right? So it just continues to add different dimensions, and it's all about beating opponents in different ways at this point, unless you are so unstoppable in one particular fashion. But yeah, no, he just adds so many dimensions to this team. It is phenomenal. And I want to say this, I think coach of the year is Mike Pressler's job to lose just by virtue of how it tends to go, you know, kind of parallel with success of a team, especially when you want to consider rebound off of last year. But if, like, Coach of the Year and GM of the Year were two different awards, I'm nominating Jim Stagnita. Like, I think he's going on the medal stand even for Coach of the Year right now. But I'm nominating him for GM of the Year, if that was an actual thing. Because, yeah, like you mentioned, trading for Ryan Conrad, trading for Levi Anderson, losing no players to do it. It is, I mean, I understand that draft picks will turn into players, but, you know, who knows what they could actually get. It's like, you know, trading a seed and getting like a tree, right? You know, who knows what that seed was going to do? Maybe it was going to do nothing. Who knows? But you got a whole ass tree now with Ryan Conrad. That's a good deal. So, I mean, pulling those off and the moves he has made, I mean, TJ Malone grabbing him, I mean, just he has just had a phenomenal year from a GM standpoint. So yeah, GM of the year, even though it does not exist, I'm giving my vote, which does not also not exist, to Jim Stagnita.
You know, Stags often laughs off, talking out of the side of his mouth sometimes. He's like, you know, no one wants to help us out. No one wants to trade with us. No one wants to give me draft picks. No one wants to give me players. This is why, Stags, you deploy these players perfectly, and you put them into these schemes, and you ask them to do just the right things. It's all making sense why there's no other teams very eager to help out the Whipsnakes, who still have the most PLL championships at any club with two, everyone else with four or none, as we roll into the future of the PLL, and that is to say Friday night's nightcap. PLL After Dark returns to Denver with the CJ Curse game. And Rosie, I pose this question to you. Did the Water Dogs actually win this game?
Well, what do you mean there? Elaborate. You mean as opposed to losing it? Like, or what do you mean there?
Okay, well, so they did, in fact, context for the listeners that did not see the results, they did, in fact, lose this game in overtime, 12-13, but they've all but secured the rights to pick first in the 2025 draft, and thus, therefore, there have you. That's a long-term victory in my mind.
I see what you're saying now. I thought you meant, like, did they, you know, screw up, or did the, did the Redwoods, you know, win based on their abilities, or was it a choke job? I thought he meant that kind of
right. Way. I say all that to say, like, the Redwoods knowing, obviously, none of the, we prefaced this last week, none of the players want to lose, but when you're a GM, and you got to look at the whole picture, trust the process, and you look at what your score differential is, and this is another concern I want to raise up to you, Rosie. When are we going to go, like, look at that Baltimore decision to call that game early? 13-goal score differential is not good. It's probably something you want to make up in the last 9 minutes, almost 10 minutes of game action, and you call that game early because there was no end in sight with the Storms. Players and coaches got flights to catch. I get it. I get it. But you really got to play the end of that game to cut that deficit a little bit to give yourself a chance. If you're going to win in overtime the next week, as you did, you got to give yourself more of a chance to overcome the score differential with the chaos.
Yeah, definitely. It is a very rare situation how that played out. And ultimately unfortunate. I guess they just kind of cross their fingers and hope it won't matter. You know, it certainly might. But
minus 13.
back to like what you were saying, it is a pretty decent consolation prize for losing this game, for the Water Dogs.
Oh, it was perfect.
Right. And what's another loss what they win anyway, right? One more loss. I will say, like, if they did know they were going to lose, they certainly – this is probably the worst way to lose another one-goal game, an overtime one. But, yes.
It's the best way, though. At the same time, it is the best way because – You look like you were right in it. And at the very end, we just didn't get that last bounce, coach. It's sorry we had to lose that year. That is the extra stinging part. Losing at Bill Tierney's Denver is tough. That's definitely tough.
Yes, with a Denver product scoring that last goal and ripping his heart out like he did. The camera crew, I guess, was right on top of that. Like, if you ever see, like, March Madness or, you know, college football, they always do this. Anytime there's like the buzzer beater, the Final Four or something like that, they are right cutting to some kid in the stands who is devastated, or like, you know, some guy who is dressed up head to toe in like face paint and just can't, you know, fathom what his life has become because, you know, somebody hits that shot. The PLL camera crew was right on Bill Tierney as soon as that goal goes. They were like, and Goldberg, and camera two, go. And it was just, you could just see the look on his face, and he was just like, oh my, how is this happening again? How are none of these bounces going our way? I do feel bad for anyone losing that many times in such a close, heartbreaking fashion. And like you mentioned, in his own backyard and like that, it's a lot. That guy has been through a lot this year.
Five of the eight losses have been by one goal. Six of the eight by one possession. And yeah, just another heartbreak for Philly here. Westberg delivers the game winner for the Redwoods. What are some other things that you liked out of California's performance to get their third win of the season?
Well, it's kind of weird, right? There were so many unique contributors in this California game that have not been contributing consistently on the offensive side this year, right? Like Nekhai Montgomery goes off with his best offensive game. Charlie Bertrand with a hat trick, his best offensive game. There are several components that just started working. And the strategy that I heard was, you know, hey, listen, we're going to let Nekhai get some runs because he hadn't really gotten as many runs on the offensive side over the past few weeks. Started out with heavy, heavy offensive runs, but, you know, based on turnovers and lack of production, they scaled it back. And, you know, I mean, because you have no choice, right? You got to do that. And they just kind of said, well, you know, let's see what he can do today. And you got these performances from guys who haven't really been performing that way, which is, on one hand, encouraging if you're Nat St. Laurent and the Redwoods, right? Because you're like, oh, okay, you know, we've got some solid things here after all. You know, we don't have to get rid of everybody. We don't have to hit the reset button on this. But on the other hand, you're like, I kind of thought we were going to reset some of this stuff, and now you're making my job a little bit tougher now, right? It's like if you fail all your tests, but then you get like an A on your final, you know, it's like, oh, okay. All right. I know this stuff. Like, you got to take the course again, you know, you still got to take the course again. But you're like, okay, this is a lot better than I thought it was.
You're still outside of the playoff picture, California, but you did well to get that third win. It was nice. It was nice to see, and just to transition into Saturday's action, the two top teams of each conference battling out on ABC to start the day, coming up against the USA men's basketball, the gold medal match going on in kind of the same time. It was pretty epic for sports fans. And then it started with kind of all the things you would hope for in the two top teams of each conference a meeting for the first time this season. And then some sloppiness stepped in and Jeff Teat took over. He was involved in the last five goals. He finished with 7 points. His MVP status, I think, has been cemented since before the All-Star break when he tied the single-season points record. And just another MVP showing from him. Finding Xander Dickson with BTB passes, and when he wasn't throwing him BTB passes, Xander Dickson was finishing with BTB goals. Then just quick release shots, and Dox Akin came in for Connor Schellenberger, and Ronan Jacoby chipped in too, and Schellenberger didn't play in the second half with a lower body injury that we'll be sure to try to get more information out of his status moving forward. All to say, another terrific display from the Bulls. Although, Rosie, I got to get this quick rant off my chest before we welcome on a very esteemed guest. The Archers were complaining about greasers in this game. And they had 27 turnovers, 18 of which were on forced, and they're out here complaining about greasers. The Atlas were using the same balls. This is ridiculous. Like, you can't be complaining about the balls being too slick. They had Seth Tierney, the head of the PLL, a man who's been coaching at he's the Team USA senior coach now. The Hofstra head coach for years, and he's out here at halftime switching every single ball on the sideline at the end line, and it was hilarious to see. Rosie, we now bring on a very special guest, the 2023 number one overall pick from Cornell, Atlas close defenseman. It's Gavin Adler. Gavin, what's up?
What's going on, guys? Appreciate you guys having me on.
Yeah, thanks for joining, man. Appreciate you making some time out of your night here. It's been fun following your season. Rosie and I have both been kind of delighted to see you in full health here too in your second summer playing pro ball, and it's really showed. Just a defensive player of the year caliber season that you're putting forth for Atlas. Two wins in your rookie season, and now only two losses. So far, 7-2 with one game to go in the regular season. You know, Rosie, I wrote about the Atlas turnaround a few weeks back. Of course, I've always got to throw in the article plugs in there, as Rosie knows.
Of course.
And the main part of the story was about Jeff Teat, of course, because he had the stats and the MVP caliber season was stacking up and all these points, and he's getting all the acclaim. I only had a few lines about Gavin Adler and the defense. Gavin, that wasn't right. I had to have you on the podcast as a result. And that was sort of the problem from last year. The two areas that head coach Mike Pressler wanted to see improved most was the transition defense and the 32-second offense. But to come from the last in the league team defense to now in the top four team defense-wise, scores allowed through nine games, what's it been like to kind of lead this turnaround with a talented group down there?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the nice words to start. I think not just looking defensively, I think just a turnaround as a whole. Obviously, you said, you know, 2-9, but you look at last year's team and you look at this year's team. We have a similar but honestly much different group right now. I mean, you could look at the moves in the draft, free agency, and the offseason coming off of 2-9. You know, this team's much stronger than last year. The guys returning are individually and collectively just playing better, you know, plus the additions of our draft picks. Obviously, Coach Pressler made some controversial decisions over the past year and a half, and that was only to put us in the best position to succeed. Not many people agree with, but we trusted it and trusted each other, most importantly. I think the biggest thing with that turnaround is our coaching staff has just done an unbelievable job of fielding a roster with the best talent possible, but most importantly, talent that fits together as players and as people. You know, you need players who fit the identity of what you're trying to accomplish on and off the field. And, you know, most talented or best players on paper don't always create or, you know, don't usually create the most successful team. So I think it's just a testament to our coaching staff developing that roster that fits together, but also with players who want to be around each other and want to play for each other. I personally love this team so much. It's been the most fun summer of my life, and I'm 24 years old. It's crazy to say, but every week I look forward to playing and just looking forward to hanging out with the guys, competing with and for them. So I would say that was the biggest thing with that turnaround.
You know, so obviously a big contribution from the defense, but I did want to ask from an offensive standpoint, Gavin, you are 1-1 shooting 100% for your career. is there an itch to kind of step and get a little bit more offensively involved, or you kind of want to, you know, hang it up on the 100%?
Yeah, we actually joke about that. I mean, all throughout college, I would shoot after practice and stuff. Like, I could actually handle the ball and play offense. I think for me, it's just, you know, throughout my days at Cornell and throughout playing on the Atlas, you know, you run down past the midline and Jeff Teed or Cornell, you know, CJ Kearse is standing right there. I think giving them the ball is a lot better of a percentage than me, unless I'm wide, wide open. But also, you know, it takes a little bit of energy to run down the field, and I think it might take a hit on, you know, my endurance of having to cover someone running back. But I just try to make the smart play. If it's there, it's there. If not, you know, I don't look for it. But I guess if time comes, I'll let it fly. But otherwise, I'm just looking to get to eat the ball. He's got Xander and Shelly down there. Good things will probably happen.
Makes sense.
From your rookie season, you hit on it there. Just to go from 2 wins to now a 7-2 team going into all but likely to secure your bye in the first round of the PLL playoffs with that score differential you're sporting. What's been some of the biggest differences from year one to year two for you? Mike Pressler mentioned to us media that you weren't playing 100% healthy in your first year. What were you dealing with? And how are you feeling now? And especially like off the field too, or some of the things that's gone into your preparation each week?
Yeah, I guess I can give you the whole rundown with the touch on everything, the big picture. That, I mean, coming off last year, I guess coming into the year, you don't realize until you get into the PLL, you know, it's a much different game and a lifestyle in college. The speed of the game is different. The rules are different. And honestly, the players are much better. I compare it to the jump from high school to college. But, you know, your rookie year coming straight out of college off a grueling, you know, 6-month season, honestly 10 months because you're there throughout the off season, and you going onto a team and a culture that's, you know, you're leaving one that's embedded in you. That's a massive change. And it takes time to adjust to that and adjust to the league. And for me, you know, I struggled. Like, my body was put through the ringer going into last season. It took me a while to figure out the proper routine to prepare for games. Obviously, an everyday lifestyle change from college, but, you know, with so much pressure on me, a bad season, and getting hurt training on my own time, like, it was a mess. And that adversity, something I embrace, I honestly love it. And it was just a long, long 8-month off season, you know, coming off that injury. So I actually tore my calf playing, and then I came back from the playoff game and I made it a lot worse. And, you know, looking back, I'm happy with the decision I made to play. You know, it was a playoff game, and I would do anything out there for those guys. But it took a lot longer than I thought to recover from that. And, you know, you couple that with everyone just bashing me, my teammates, my coach, it just made me come back with a serious vengeance, and honestly one that's not going away. So I thought about that season every day throughout the off season. It's such a different change, you know, being 8 months removed from the game. Obviously a lot different from college. It felt similar to the time I had 2 seasons canceled at Cornell, and, you know, how hard I worked, stay consistent to the process without any expectation or result. Obviously, you know, that long 8 months, it prepared me physically, but especially mentally. So I learned so much from that. And year one, obviously the learning curve, right? Like, helps you grow, help me personally grow into a better player, teammate. And honestly, looking back at it, like, that, the good or the bad, you know, whether how this season goes, like, those same principles apply to anything I'm doing, and I kind of just fall back on that. You know, just willing to outwork anyone, don't take any shortcuts. And I've been through a lot of things that are a lot deeper that drive me, but like I said before, like, I love the game so much, just obsessed with the inputs, and just am addicted to getting better. And I still think, you know, like I said, a lot to learn from in year one and year two. I still think I'm such a young, inexperienced player, and there's so much room for growth in the game of lacrosse. I mean, how I look at it is, like, I only played 2 full seasons of college lacrosse and 8 games last year, so I really haven't played that much lacrosse, and I just want to get better every day. And everyone who knows me personally knows that, like, I'm not doing this for myself. I want to win more than anything in this world, and I've never won anything significant. Obviously, you guys know my career and everything that's happened there. So, especially with how much I love this team, there's seriously nothing I want more than to hoist that trophy with these guys. So, just everything combined over those months just got me here. But like I said, you know, falling back on the same things that have embedded me over time.
So, you know, you kind of mentioned the preparation that goes into it, and just, you know, what fuels you and has, you know, kind of kept you fueled over these months. We talked to your coach, Mike Pressler, after the Denver game. He was talking about the O'Neal matchup and said you'd kind of had that circled for about a year. Is it common practice to kind of have matchups, you know, that you anticipate, you know, planning out weeks or months in advance, or was that a particularly unique situation?
I mean, definitely was on my mind for some time. I mean, I never went against Brennan in college, him specifically. I mean, he's obviously such an unbelievable player, as you guys all know him as. And I just look at that like a challenge. Like, I would just want and embrace that challenge on the field competitively. And that's really all it was. It's not like I was talking about it. I think he kind of just said that to say it. But, yeah, obviously, you know, throughout the year you look forward to hopefully covering some guys and playing against some of the world's best players. So, yeah, I mean, I would say I definitely look forward to it competitively. But then, you know, over time, prepare for it too. You know, I'm watching months of film on these guys and, you know, whether it's the college players or the pro players, watching them play. So,
was there a pro player who, like, before you, you know, maybe got into the PLL, who you had kind of thought, you know, oh, man, you know, next year I'm going to go one-on-one against this guy? Maybe somebody you kind of looked up to in the past?
I would probably have to say Sowers, just because of the Princeton-Cornell rivalry, and within that 2020 season, that, you know, still holds a place in my heart. Obviously, me and Jeff T, teammates for that season, canceled at 5-0. Princeton was also 5-0, and Sowers was on a tear, and we were looking forward to that matchup. And I never covered him in college. Guys were asking me the other day, how we were talking about how many times you covered Sowers in college. They were like 3 or 4. I was like, I've never played against him. So that was something that I look forward to, just because, you know, obviously how great he is, and obviously small, quick matchup. But even other guys I watch play throughout the years, like Tom Schreiber and Zed and all those guys, have just, you know, surreal watching them play throughout my time growing up, and then just getting to cover them in a game. It's an awesome challenge, and obviously they're unbelievable players.
Yeah, just going back to that feature I wrote about your Atlas squad, just talking to Jeff about the turnaround and sort of his Cornell career, and then touching on you a little bit, I was like, what was it like? Did you ever go one-on-one against Gavin after practice? Man, he was like, nah, man, I'm staying away from that. So the best player in indoor and outdoor wants no business of the Gavin Adler one-on-one treatment.
We went against each other every day for 2 years. I mean, we've played a lot of lacrosse against each other. And, I mean, I can credit Jeff for sitting here right now. Like, he's been a huge part of my success and someone that's always believed in me from – when I stepped on campus at Cornell to the point I wasn't playing my freshman year. And he kind of always told me that I was going to be here, and him instilling that confidence in me just meant the world to me, but it was everything to me to prove him right. And, you know, I've had a few people over the years that were, you know, with me from that very beginning, but even just covering Jeff every day on the scout team was just, I mean, obviously it was an unreal moment for me, but he made me so much better on and off the field. So I'm couldn't be more, I guess, happy or excited for, you know, my future with him and the Atlas as a whole. So
for our listeners here, there's plenty of practice time with Jeff, but not a lot of competitive action with Cornell. We mentioned the canceled season. So the 2020 season you alluded to got cut short for COVID, and the 21 season, the Ivy League opts not to participate. Jeff Teat, that's his last season of eligibility. He goes into the draft, and you still have a couple more years of college left. Were those few games of 2020 just the only games that you played before coming into the Atlas together?
Yeah, I mean, I was on the team in 2019, but I had a rough freshman year. I was hurt and I wasn't on the field. I mean, competed in practice and whatever, but actually on the field, yeah, it was 2020, those 5 games. And then, you know, that gets canceled. And Jeff actually came back to play in 2021 with 5 other of those guys. And you kind of look at that team, and you're like, CJ Kirsch, Jeff Teat, same attack line. I mean, we had a great squad back then. But just throughout that year, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, it's just the time you spend together off the field. It doesn't even feel like we only played five games together because, you know, he's one of my best friends throughout the time. But, yeah, that was it. And throughout that time, I mean, Jeff made, like, one of the most respectable decisions I've ever seen from a player, obviously as highly touted as he was throughout that entire year. You know, all that stuff goes down, and, you know, he's up at Cornell practicing with eight guys, and you hear all the stuff about him transferring to Denver and not anywhere in the country. But I remember just sitting with him in February and March, just, like, watching all the other teams play. And, like, it wasn't even a question in his mind to not go play anywhere else. Then you just watch him get drafted first overall and put on the performance he did his rookie year. I mean, I learned so many valuable lessons from that, but it also steered my decision of, you know, I had an extra year of eligibility, too, to play. And I had no idea at the time, you know, what my stock was in the PLL. This decision had to be made way before my senior season. And I put all my eggs in one basket, and exactly like he did. And if he wasn't there to show me that way, I'm not saying I would have done anything else, but, you know, that really helped steer my decision and just grew my respect for him. So I'm not sure many people know that, but that speaks for who he is.
No, that's awesome to hear. To the TD Erland leak to the post-game podcast, untrue. Jeff Teat did not, in fact, transfer to the University of Denver or Denver University. Gavin, you're a guy who gets fueled off just what other people say. Not solely off that. That's not what I'm presenting here. But a guy who might keep some receipts and likes to prove people wrong. A guy who's been called undersized. You weren't a top 100 recruit coming into college. What was it like for you, your ascension to becoming that number one overall pick? How much pride do you have in kind of becoming that top prize overall and one of the best defensemen now in the pro ranks?
Yeah, well, I mean, like I said, with the good and the bad, you know, I just try to stick to what's got me here and everything I mentioned before and just falling back on my training. And yeah, obviously, you know, there's been a lot of receipts kept over the years and stuff that still fuels me, and just everything I went through with recruiting and, you know, what people said about me playing the position and how hard it was to actually get to Cornell, and, you know, just finding the few people that believed me. But once I got to Cornell, you know, I never saw a team like that or been a part of a team like that and had such great teammates and best friends that I realized there was so much more to play for than yourself. And, like, really everything I was doing was playing for Cornell and my teammates who were my best friends. And that just gave me another perspective on things and really blocked out what anyone else said or any personal success. Like, I really did not care and still don't anything else. Like I said, and I'm getting that same feel and vibe from the Atlas that we kind of did not have last year. And that's really what drives me so much further. But, you know, just trying not to get caught up in those moments and, you know, just being team first. Like, you know, like you mentioned, feeling that number one pick, but at the same time, like, for me, I was like, all right, well, we had a playoff game to win versus Michigan that week, and, you know, I felt that it was kind of a distraction and just trying not to get, but yeah, obviously, you know, the people around me probably loved it a lot more than I did, but at the same time, you still appreciate it, respect it, but you try not to lose focus over it. So it's kind of the same place I'm at, and I just try to stay consistent with that mentality with everything I do, because there's going to be a lot, you know, very bad, like last off season, and there could be good depending on what happens at the end of September with the Atlas. So that's really just my perspective on it.
You know, so you just mentioned the difference between last year and this year, just how it's been, you know, a real big turnaround as far as, you know, emotions and just the feeling, understandably so, you know, in the whole locker room. Sure. But you also have some changes at the goalie position behind you. And this year, you know, you start off playing defense with Tim Trautner behind you. And, you know, after a few games, now you have Liam Entman in there. So just from a defenseman perspective and also just like off field, what have been some of the differences between kind of working with those guys and what's kind of contrast in their styles?
Yeah, I mean, Tim and Liam are definitely two different players. I mean, on and off the field, but similar at the same time. Both two of the best teammates I've been. How I watched him handle that situation was unbelievable. It was inspiring, honestly. You know, you guys know the story and everything coming in. You know, Liam, highly touted draft pick, but Tim is playing extremely well. And there was no second guessing or anything, and everyone just wanted what was the best for the team. But, you know, playing with Tim, he's a veteran. He's had a lot of success in this league. An amazing dude off the field, but kind of like a coach too. And, you know, Liam gets in there. I've obviously watched him play for years. I didn't know him personally, and I couldn't have been more pumped to play with him. But now actually playing with him, it's even more exciting. I mean, he's the ultimate competitor. I absolutely love that from him. Like, he's one of the dudes I just absolutely love playing with and for. And I really could not be more excited, you know, for the rest of this year and whatever our future holds together. And, you know, Liam's going to learn a lot from Tim, and he's such a great mentor to him. So I think, you know, that situation, or, you know, Liam, how he is right now, wouldn't be the same without Tim. And we all know that. And, you know, Tim in the same boat, you know, I think they're both better players and teammates, people, because of that. And it's just been awesome to have those two on the squad together. Helps our defense a lot too. So.
Oh yeah. No, I bet. Rosie asked the question earlier of who you were excited to guard the next level, which pros, and your answer really indicated what makes you such a special defenseman, being able to guard guys like Zed Williams, but also guys like Michael Sowers. Two completely different matchups. To a guy who's straight up strength and wants to bully ball you versus a guy who wants to the speed past you. This past weekend, you bump up some to come out and play the reigning MVP in Tom Schreiber. How much does that how much do you relish in the opportunity to showcase your versatility defensively, and how much preparation goes into that during the week before you're like, hey, I can do anything to help my team win?
Yeah, I think that comes from that just deeper force, like I was saying, about getting recruited and just me feeling like, all right, I have to be able to cover everywhere on the field at every spot so someone could find me. And, you know, with that over time, like my coach at Cornell, I think the first two practices, like I was playing Jeff Teat like out to the sidelines and just kind of just running with him and playing. I was like, should I stop doing this? He's like, no, this is what's going to make you great. And then just from there, just trying to develop that in my game. But like you said, the versatility of the different guys, and this is a weird take and perspective, but honestly something that's helped me grow into being able to do that is obviously first, like I said, that brand of just being relentless and being able to play wherever. But second, I've studied so much NFL cornerback film, especially Darrelle Revis. And you might be saying, oh, yeah, Revis, obviously best corner of all time.
Revis Island, baby.
Deion, but no, there's something about Revis that makes him so great. Like, he was not the biggest corner at all. He was not the most jacked-looking athletic dude at all. I mean, he was probably about, like, 5'10", smaller guy, whatever. But, like, when people say, like, what's great footwork, and I ask people that when I'm training these kids, like, people really don't have an answer, but I've developed like what I think great footwork is and learned from him. But he was so, I'm trying to think of the word. I mean, he was incredibly amazing at the fundamentals of his footwork, of how he moved off his feet. And that allowed him to move so efficiently with these fast receivers, like whether it was Steve Smith or, you know, he was so strong for how he looked to cover a guy like Calvin Johnson or Andre Johnson. So learning his approach and like kind of how he took on those guys and what the difference was playing a big guy to playing one of those fast guys. Cause obviously, like I said, he's not the biggest guy in the world. And I kind of just try to take things away in the lacrosse game and, you know, have them correlate. And I've actually learned a lot about playing in space and, you know, playing out to the 45 yard line, not giving guys a 10 yard start, because, you know, it's a lot easier playing defense when you're 2 yard cushion and a guy doesn't have a running start. But a lot goes into that, and you know, you have to prepare a lot for that, and that's helped me prepare, you know, in otherworldly manner. And I think just whatever the matchup is, you know, that competitive approach of like, okay, I need to do what's best for the team, like I need to win this so like we can win the game. And at the same time, just, you know, falling back on everything I've done to get there and, you know, being great at the fundamentals and studying different things, being creative with it. But, yeah, I mean, the approach, you know, weather covering, wherever, I honestly like playing up top better than I like playing down low. I just think it's more fun. You have a lot more range. You know, it's not as close to the goal. You can take longer angles and you can be a little bit more aggressive. So in that sense, like, I look forward to bumping up and playing in the midfield whenever coach asks me to do that. But I guess, like I said, playing a big guy, smaller guy, it's just a different approach, different fundamentals, different footwork, different point of contact. So, and I've learned a lot of that from Revis, honestly. And I'm not just saying that to say it. You know, you go deep in the film and you can see what made that guy great and how he changed his approach to whether it's Calvin or Steve Smith. So,
you know, so that brings me to the next thing I really have been dying to ask you about personally. You mentioned Darrell Revis, which is a perfect segue here because of a New York legend. Week two last season, you pulled up to Charlotte wearing a pair of white and orange and blue Starberries. Now, I've been dying to know. You guys won that game, of course. Beat the Whipsnakes 12-11. What is the origin story that gets a guy your age in some Starberries? Was it appreciation for Stephon Marbury himself, or is it for the shoe?
Yeah, honestly, I'm a huge Knick fan just growing up, and you know, the Starberries are old school. I just thought they were swag, and I was like, all right, first time on the bus, like, let me just throw them on. I mean, I got a lot of questions from that too. I mean, I've had them for a while. They're just like, you know, one of those shoes, you got to keep them clean. You only wear them a certain time. I was like, yeah, perfect time.
No, yeah, they're phenomenal. They're absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, that's funny you asked that. I'm not expecting that, but.
I definitely did not pick up on that as a non-sneakerhead, so I'm glad you filled us in a little bit there, Rosie. Gavin, you've mentioned the recruiting story a few times here during the interview. Just for listeners who are not as familiar with it, take us through what you went through to get to Cornell. I know you verbally committed to Marquette first, and then you switched over to Cornell. What was that recruiting process like for you? And again, you mentioned it shaped a lot of your mindset.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give it to you guys as quick as I can. I'll probably miss a lot, but growing up, I started playing fifth grade. I was actually an ex-attackman until about seventh or eighth grade. I tried out for this club team, FLG. They only had defensive spots left. They didn't have any attack spots, so I was like, ah, whatever. I'm trying out as a pole, and I'll try to switch over, try to make the team as a pole. And I actually made the team, and I was just like, yeah, this is kind of fun. I don't have to get welded on all the time. But, like, I was extremely undersized, like, all throughout high school. I mean, I got pulled. Steven DiNapoli, he was a captain of the Water Dogs. He was my coach in high school. So just having a guy like that got me throughout. But I was extremely undersized. And recruiting, you know, there were no rules back then. So in eighth, ninth grade, a lot of these D1 schools had their classes filled out. And I'm 5'4", 120 running around out there. Like, no one's even looking at me. But same time, I was doing well, and I was still played like the same way I played. And you know, I got to 10th grade, I got a little bigger. I actually had a great high school season. I started guarding top guys, and I was doing fairly well for myself, and you know, other coaches thought so too. But I was just extremely undersized, but at the same time, I was guarding guys who were committed to, you know, pretty good schools. So I was like, you know, like I can play at this level. And I always believed that, and Steve DiNapoli especially always believed that. And that 10th grade fall, I got cut from my club team, and I had nothing. Like, you got to think about the club circuit. All these teams had their rosters filled out. So this guy, Ken Miller, coached Long Island Sting, like old club team. Guys fly in from everywhere, play a tournament. It's so gritty because, like, you're really just doing it to get recruited. And he loved me. I mean, he told me every day, like, I would be – do what I did at Cornell, and he believed in me, and he never stopped. And DeNap was he played with Joe Ample at Marquette, and DeNap was hounding him. I really never even spoke to a college coach. No one answered my emails. I had, when I say zero offers, I mean zero offers. And DeNap hounded Ample, and he's like, all right, I'll get him on a visit, whatever. And I mean, I think Ample is one of the best coaches out there, and I want to go to Marquette for him, but I didn't love Marquette. I actually didn't really want to go there, but it was the only opportunity I had to play. So I'm thankful Ample gave me that opportunity. But at the same time, you know, they didn't see me as a great recruit. It was more of a favor, and I respected that. And, you know, throughout, I committed there November of my junior year, so very late. And I kept playing at all these tournaments because my Ken Miller, my coach, was like, someone's going to find you. And he kept emailing. He's like, all right, let's go to Middlebury. We got to, like, I hit up D3 schools. A lot of them, they didn't want me. I mean, my grades weren't great. They weren't that bad. And I get through that summer and nothing. And I'm playing high school football in September, committed kid in high school, kind of chilling, whatever. And it's like late September. I've had no thoughts of going anywhere. I'm like, this is it. Like going for like last 3 months. I'm playing a game of Madden, and Ken Miller calls me. He's like, you got to pick up your phone right now. And he's like screaming. I was like, I thought it was the Middlebury coach. And like, he didn't tell me who was calling. So I was like, all right, like, what's this going to be? And like, I still remember like vividly just that call. And it was Coach Stevens from Cornell. And like, obviously surreal to me because Max Seabold's a Cornell legend. And I grew up five houses over from him. So I always looked up to him. I actually played with a Cornell dyedhead growing up throughout middle school. So that was that. And then honestly, it was my first time talking to a coach. I mean, like, obviously smart, respectful, but like, I gave him my story. I was like, look, man, like, I just need someone to take a chance on me. And he loved it. And he's like, dude, I actually see like a lot of potential in you, but he never saw me play. And I never even knew how he found me. It was Ken Miller. That guy sent my highlight tape to him. And this was in September. Like, I was so long gone. And I was like, I don't even know what he wanted. I don't even know what he said, but they got me up there, and like, I sold them just in person of how we interacted on my visit. And, you know, they kind of told me I was going to play LSM, and I was like, whatever. And, you know, just got up there and made the most of my opportunity. And, you know, obviously Coach Stevens didn't believe in me like that. I wouldn't be sitting here now. And, you know, he's one of my best friends now, such an unbelievable coach. And I mean, the year comes around, I mean, I still thank him for like doing that. I mean, it changed my life, like, straight up. So that was in short, quick summary of all that went down. But I had nothing. I mean, before the college games, like my friends, so like, I would like read the emails to these guys and go out there and just want to tear them apart. That was it.
It was perfect summation, and I am ready to run through four brick walls for you, Gavin. That is an incredible story. The thing about it is, being coached by DiNapoli at and then the high school level, and Jordan Stevens in the at Cornell, and now KU at Atlas, Kevin Onnerstein, the former Hofstra defensive midfielder, Team USA guy. What is it about some of these guys who are just super gritty and guys who just fire everyone up that really resonates with you especially?
Yeah, they're just like-minded people. I mean, I can get a KU on the other end. Obviously, you've seen him from his playing days. Like, I watched him growing up, loved his game, just a hard-nosed, tough defensive midfielder who's as athletic as anyone. Just him personally, like, he coaches how he plays, and he's so fun to be around. I honestly think he's such a great coach. I think he's one of the most, if not the most underrated young coach in the game right now. And he's a brilliant defensive mind, and I think any young player out there should be itching to play for this guy. And, you know, he just got a new opportunity, so I'm excited for him. That I know he's going to make the most of it. And, you know, just like him, DeNap, Stevens, you know, they're just similar-minded guys, you know. Doesn't say that makes them great defensive coordinators, but to me that's what makes them great, and, you know, that's how I see it. And, you know, they see the game in an incredible way, so it's been – very fun to be coached by those guys.
So now, if I fast forward a little bit, since you got a bit of a bye week, what does a bye week look like for you? Especially kind of like, what are your priorities as far as, you know, your priorities on a bye week? What kind of things do you make sure you're doing or not doing to be ready when it's time to go again?
Yeah, I mean, I got to listen to my body, see how it feels, and then just get to work, right? Like, whatever I'm doing, whether I can't work out the day after a game because, you know, it's hard to move off a plane or whatever, like just get into film, stretch, you know, get in a tub, and just eating right throughout the week, like just being on a strict diet has helped me, you know, stay healthy too, and just working hard during the week, getting reps on the field, getting in the gym, and especially the film. So I think it's a combination of all those three, and then, you know, just having a great practice the day before the game, just going out there to compete. I mean, there's such limited opportunity in these PLL games that you just got to come in so prepared and so hungry to play. That's what makes the league special, in my opinion, too. You got to make the most of your time.
No, 100%. And, Gavin, we've gone through your origin story, your recruiting story, and your Atlas and Cornell story. Just, yeah, you wore 88 as a rookie. You're back to your number 77 jersey. What's the number 77 mean to you? Why do you wear it, and what's its significance?
Yeah, so I actually wore 43 my freshman year at Cornell, and there was this defenseman on the team. He was a senior. His name was Tom Riley. He wore 77, and he was just one of those dudes when I was struggling that just always believed in me and instilled confidence, you know, to the point that he kind of told me everything that was going to happen in my career at Cornell happened. And just, you know, hearing that, and, you know, you think they're crazy at first, but then you're like, you know what, I'm going to prove them right. And he supported me throughout everything I did. And, you know, when he graduated, I had no, you know, touch or significance to 77. And I was just like, yo, I'm going to wear this for you. And I honestly just like the number now. And then I got to the PLL and it was taken. And I'm not, you know, a big number guy or whatever, like play with anything. But when it was time to pick a new number, like just one of my best friends from Cornell, he played defense, kid J.Q. Stramanak, one of the best teammates and people I've been around, tore his ACL twice and just came back, relentless dude, glue guy in the locker room, team loved him. I was just like, yo, I'm wearing eights for you, and that was it. And then once 77 got back open, I was like, take it, and still special to me. So not too much behind it, but that was really it.
Sorry, last question here, and we'll get you out of here, Gavin. Just the fact that you guys picked up your last win against the defending champs won, but the message post-game was more so about the fact that it came after your bye week. The two league-mandated byes after week three earlier in the season and after the All-Star break, presented your team's first two losses. Now you get some confidence from getting a win after a bye week this time out, and now having likely secured the bye week and the Eastern Conference playoff picture. Just again, just how size up how important that was of a win for you guys as you march toward the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, you look at how the second half of the season has went, a little different than the first half. I think that game was a telling point to, you know, how we're going to be going forward, and honestly a statement game. You know, coming off the bye, we haven't had success, especially against a great team like that. You know, we knew we needed to show up and win that game. You know, I don't know what our record would have been, maybe like 2-3 in our last five or something like that, and you know, our trajectory probably not looking as good, you know, not getting that win. So we knew that was important. But like I said, you know, it's just game by game and focusing on that and now just getting the next one. So obviously really important going to the playoffs, but can't get away from this one on Saturday. And then, you know, just take it game by game going forward.
Gavin, we really appreciate you joining the show. Great luck coming into the regular season finale here against your boy, Michael Sowers, and the Philadelphia Water Dogs to end the regular season. And we're going to look forward to seeing you guys in the playoffs.
Yeah, appreciate it, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Yes, sir, thanks.
Have a good one.
What a appearance. Rosie, oh my God, I'm ready to just lift for 77 hours straight and tell every coach that, you know, I've still got a chance at
this. I know, right?
Thank you so much, Gavin, for joining the show. That was really awesome of you. And Man, the Atlas are going to be tough to beat with mindsets like that. Let's wrap up the Week 10 action from Denver with the host getting their homecoming win after a disappointing loss on Friday night. Rosie, this was a grudge match of epic proportions. Just 2 goals in the first quarter, 2 goals in the second quarter, 4 goals in that first half. Breaks open a little bit, and the Outlaws score a handful straight, and that certainly propels them to the 10-4 victory to close out the penultimate weekend of the PLL regular season. For the Outlaws, it was a great win, but we talked about them plenty. Well, before we get to chaos here, just a vintage Eric Law showing. 4 goals, as many matches the Chaos goal total. Rosie, just size up. What was it like seeing a former Outlaw just ball out like that at Peter Barton Stadium, where he played his college ball too?
Yeah, I mean, so in a weekend that was just loaded with Denver alums absolutely delivering, you know, Eric Law was kind of the homecoming king, kind of joining Jeff Traynor's Boston residency as, you know, going home and lighting it up. The 4 goals for him. And the interesting thing I thought about Eric Law was, you know, obviously there's a huge story that we've all discussed plenty about, you know, the Denver guy going back home to Denver and, you know, just in time for homecoming weekend and all that. And it was very exciting for him. But also, I figured there must have been a lot of pressure. You know, he's kind of tasked with leading a very young team and performing this environment where everyone is looking at him, you know, expecting him to, you know, he's not expected to necessarily have, you know, 7 goals or something like that, but he is the leader of that team on the offensive side. So, you know, just asked him if there was a lot of pressure, because he had previously commented that he was excited and happy and proud, you know, to go back at home and, you know, show everybody what Denver lacrosse is all about. But yeah, he said, you know, he did want to say that he was the one who put it on himself, which is an important clarification. But he said, yeah, you know, there was a ton of pressure, you know, just wanting to make sure everything went well and, you know, performing on that stage that is a unique stage for him in that particular time and location. And he said something that I thought was also kind of, you know, revealing. He said, yeah, it was great, but I'm really kind of glad it's over. You know, it's a relief that that weekend is past him. And, you know, he can just worry about being a lacrosse player from here on out. You know, he just has to be tasked with helping his team. And he doesn't have any more focus of being, you know, Mr. Denver back in Denver. But under that intense microscope, he did perform very well and scored the opening goal in both matchups, which is just, you know, getting that crowd into things. You know, I mean, who better than your hometown boy to lead the way that way?
No one, really. No one is better to lead the way, because Eric Law is an outlaw, as we say in the PLL Happy Hour podcast quarters. And listen, holding the Chaos to a season low goals may not seem like a big deal, but when it's 4 goals, it is, because that is not very many. And man, was it tough to watch at certain points. Rosie, McElroy played well, the defense played well, but Carolina was certainly missing a certain someone.
Yeah, absolutely. Josh Byrne was out of the lineup at his brother's wedding. So it's nothing injury related. So, you know, if you are a Chaos fan, you'll be happy to know he should be back suited up the rest of the way for you guys, which is quite a relief if you were a little concerned about his absence. But yeah, that being said, no one else could really step up and produce. Obviously, Josh Byrne has some big shoes to fill. But the players who were there, there was a lot of sloppiness. And that was really the key issue. Granted, Denver does deserve a great deal of credit. You know, their defensive adjustments, especially with a starter in Jesse Bernhardt going down, have been tremendous. You know, the goalie play has been solid. Faceoff work was solid as well. Excellent work against Carolina in that department. But yeah, you know, a lot of it just came down to sloppiness. Turnovers that were unnecessary. You know, you get the game going a little too fast for you, it seems sometimes. You're prone to throwing the ball out of bounds or something like that. They shot 9.3% for the game, 0 for 10 in their two-point attempts. It just was a game where I don't think there's a lot they're going to take away from it from an educational standpoint, because of the fact that there were so many unforced turnovers and that it was just kind of sloppy play. It is probably one of those games that they're just going to kind of ball up and throw away. You know, I guess the lesson is you get fewer opportunities to make those mistakes. You really only have one more, and then your season is over. But I think they're going to have to, you know, kind of just rinse this all off and start again next week with Byrne in the lineup again. You know, not to say that he would have totally made this game different, you know, because if he's setting up his offense with some assist opportunities and they're still dropping the ball or something like that or missing the cage, both of which were plentiful in this game, you know, there's only so much one man can do. So I don't think it's a situation where you can strictly blame this on Josh Byrne's absence, but it obviously contributes to some degree.
Josh Byrne, the tapes, huh? Get it?
Burn
the tapes, look at Josh Byrne. Boom. That's what we call comedy gold here at the end of the podcast, listeners. We've reached the finale, the final weekend of the PLL regular season. Not as much as we would like to be up in the up for grabs in the final week of action here, but I thought the Water Dogs would still be in play, which would have made that like Atlas Philly matchup awesome. But they're 1-8 and they stink, so not so much. What is awesome is that the Archers have not, them not winning last weekend really made things super spicy for their own homecoming, because it's a couple must-win games in order to clinch that first round bye, and two winnable games at that. They start out with the California Redwoods and they end the weekend on Saturday night against the Denver Outlaws, which if they take care of business on Friday, by all accounts, will be for that bye. Rosie, let's start there with the two Archers games. What are some things that you're looking for?
Well, the first one is a team-wide job interview for the California Redwoods, right? Who is going to be on that roster next year? And, you know, I'm sure the lesson or the pregame talk will be, you know, we're technically not out of this yet. So they're going to have to go down swinging, the likes of which we've never seen. So who steps up and delivers in that situation and who doesn't? And like I said, it's a lot of these guys are playing to prove that they deserve deals and deserve to be brought back. And, you know, we'll see who kind of steps up and who kind of either, you know, checks out a little bit or kind of shrivels under that.
Yeah, it's also a game you can't overlook if you're Utah, if you're the Archers, and you've got this epic clash on Saturday night against Denver, which could be for that bye. You really can't look a 3-6 team who's super underwhelmed this season, because you do that and you're going to get burnt. Asking Brennan O'Neill about the flip of 13 goal margin of victories that the Outlaws experienced, his answer was telling. He was like, yeah, man, if you're not ready to play, like, the teams in this league are just too good. You're going to get punished. You're going to get your butts whooped. So stay tuned for that one. The Boston Cannons versus Carolina Chaos, they close out the Friday night action in Utah, home of the 2020 bubble. Shout out the return to sports, COVID era. What's the matchup that we're looking for in this one, Rosie?
I don't know if we're going to get it. I hope we're going to get it. I want to see Eppel versus Byrne. Both players very fresh heading into this weekend. Should be no tired legs or anything like that. And, you know, I just want to see how the key contributor for the Carolina offense, you know, especially in view of last week, there's going to be a lot of sort of, you know, counting on him to deliver. And, you know, he watched the game, I'm sure, so he probably feels a bit of additional pressure to step up and deliver and get this offense back on track. And, you know, you're going to have Garrett Eppel down there trying his best to derail the whole operation. So, you know, there's some size, speed, cost turnovers versus slick assists. I want to see how that shakes out.
Yeah, it's also a game for Boston. You're coming off your own bye. You're not going to really get that first round bye, even if you'd have to beat them by how many goals? You know, Rosie, are you good at math? Well, what's the
goal count here? I'm also terrible at math.
It's the Atlas currently have a 28 score differential. The Boston Cannons are at 10, so not looking good. That's what the math is. Not looking good for their chances. Again, you don't want to lay an egg the week before the playoffs. Although we have seen in the past that when you do so, you're like extra motivated to make up for that. So who knows? Maybe Brian Holman listened to the wheels churn in my mind. Maybe you sabotage your own team and you make up for it in Gillette for the quarterfinals. So you're hosting the first round. Of course, you don't want to have that bye week. You would be so gracious. So thank you so much to the Cannons for not securing the bye.
Sure.
Saturday action starts up with the lowly Water Dogs against the fired up Atlas, as we've just heard from their fearless leader on the defensive end. Rosie, what label would you give this game for the Atlas?
I would say come on out, everyone, to watch the trappiest trap game of all time. You have a team that cannot seem to win games going against a team that just knocked down the defending champion and is feeling pretty good, as we've heard, kind of overcoming their bye week issues, you know, with a strong performance at all ends of the field. But yeah, you got this team that it has not put it together for very much time at all this season. And but again, like you mentioned, that Brandon O'Neill said, you have to be prepared for everyone. So, you know, perhaps the worst case scenario is, you know, you go out there and you just get stomped with this last gasp of air from the Water Dogs and, you know, kind of make you question everything you thought you knew as an Atlas team. So they have to be very prepared for this. You know, cornered animals are the most dangerous and Water Dogs are going down, I assume, with a fight. But I don't know. We'll have to see. I said the same thing at Homewood. So we'll have to see what they bring to the table. But yeah, trappy trap game. Got to be careful.
Got to avoid the trappiest trap games of all trap games. And that is what New York has in store for them. And yeah, especially Philadelphia is too prideful to let this game just be another loss that easily. You know, they'd be smart too, because they've already secured the CJ Kirst pick. All right, they're not going to get three wins, and you might as well try to win this time. Okay, try to win. We've reached the regular season finale between the defending champion Archers and the New Look Outlaws. Rosie, this one is going to be awesome. It's going to be the game of the weekend. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be epic. It's going to be sick. I can't wait. And if it's anything but, then I want my money back, because all things told, this is measuring up to be an important one. And before we even get to it, like, if you're Atlas or the Outlaws or the Archers, It's funny that the Whipsnakes still think they have a chance at the bye. Do you want the week off, or do you want to have that non-guaranteed spot in the semifinals?
You know, I guess there's the argument for both sides, right? You say, oh, we want to, if we're winning and feeling great, we want to just keep going. I think a lot of it comes down to if your team has key members who are hurt or a little bit banged up, you know, maybe you really just want that kind of break more than anything else. You know, we'll kind of see. There's a lot of injury talk that we're not 100% privy to right now as far as how hurt certain guys are. But that could be a very, very crucial bye. You know, if we have to see the extent of like Matt Moore's injury, right, as far as Utah goes, if it's an AC injury that's going to keep him out for the rest of the year, or if maybe he just needs another week to heal, then, you know, they've really secured the bye like it's a prize that they really needed, right? Similar situation, but I think we pretty much know how it's going to go for them. But Schellenberger news, we'll have to figure out what's going on with him. Maybe he just needs the time off. But, you know, he's probably going to get it. But, yeah, and then there's all sorts of players that we don't know about because, you know, we don't see them get hurt, right? Or we don't see them have to miss time. And they're in their own boats, right? Greg Weil from Denver. In their last game, we saw him go off the field. It was a similar exit to the one we saw his, you know, the guy he replaced in Jesse Bernhardt. They both kind of head off the field, you know, unable to move, you know, their shoulder areas. So yeah, we'll have to see what's happening with him as well. Is that a short-term thing, you know, or is he going to need some time off as well? So, yeah, a lot of these guys are in a position where, you know, as great as the talk of momentum is, maybe it comes down to really just needing to recover to get back to some semblance of full strength.
Yeah, full strength is definitely going to be important when you've got I totally just doubled there. Being full strength is definitely going to be important as you size up your run towards the championship. Goes through Philly, and listen, this regular season is wearing on me here, and we've done a long podcast. It's been great fun. We've got Boston for the quarterfinals, Long Island for the semis, Philly for the title game. Rosie, I'm super excited to cover it all with you. Give us and our listeners a parting message as we embark on the final weekend.
Absolutely. Parting message, people of Utah, the pressure is on you now. You have to follow a tremendous headlining act there in Denver. So shout out to all the people in Denver who did a great job. You're Coach Tim Sudan was very, very quick to praise you. So great work. A shout out to JoJo Wardrummer making a triumphant return on the sideline. I did not think, I'll be honest with you, I didn't think they were going to let him back. I'm very happy that the PLL embraced. And
if the Outlaws are back, JoJo's back. Yeah.
I know. They go hand in hand. So I'm very happy to see him. And not only was I happy to see him, but Tim Sudan was so happy to see him that he mentioned him twice in the post-game presser, just how great the atmosphere was. And he was like, I mean, you got JoJo back? And it's like, yeah, man, he's back too. Oh, he loved it. So, yeah, shout out to you guys. Shout out to Utah. We hope and expect big things from you guys out there hosting the event. And last but not least, shout out to my fantasy team for beating Kevin's again.
Dang it. Catch you next week. Peace.